David Hasselhoff.
Don't hassle the Hoff, mate.
You love that story.
Occasionally when we start recording, I think, are we going to have enough juice to get an intro out of this? And then it just comes.
Michael Nightmare.
Fourth would be good here, Michael.
The Germans, and they're in trouble. Alcantara couldn't do it. Lineker probably could. And England have equalised. It's Gary
Welcome, everybody, to the Final Countdown, a podcast looking back at great finals within the game of football. I am Lewis, here with my co-host, Adam.
Hello.
So before we get into the big question that we start off every podcast, it is approaching our 50th episode, and we mused in our last episode of what we would do for our special, for the 50th. What we've decided to do is wrap it up into a Christmas special rather than the 50th episode.
It's a couple of weeks' time.
Exactly. Yeah. We didn't want to break the momentum of all the World Cups that we've been going through. We want to try and get back to what we're actually doing here today, the 1974 World Cup final. Adam, what do you know?
It's the post-Jules Rimet era.
Oh, very good. Straight in there. Thanks. Facts.
Facts.
Fun and educational.
So my impression of the 74 World Cup is it's quite dour.
Okay.
Is it in Germany?
It is in Germany. Yeah. Germany host.
It's quite. I think it's just the contrast from Brazil and the sunshine.
The vivid colour.
Yeah, definitely. So obviously it's in colour still, but it just comes across. Maybe it rained a bit. So
it's interesting you say that. I wasn't going to put it in the report, but one of the things I did see when researching is that, yeah, literally the weather was very grey, very overcast, a lot of rain.
Yeah.
And it's interesting that that's one of your memories of kind of looking back.
Well, even the final is in daytime, isn't it? And it's not sunny or anything. Yeah. It's just overcast.
Mm-hmm. Overcast and moody.
Yeah.
What else do you know about the final?
The Holland move, they win a penalty without... Germany touching the ball.
Yeah, very good.
Cruyff dominating throughout the tournament.
Oh, yes.
Gerd Müller.
My boy, Johan.
Paul Breitner.
Oh, interesting. That. Paul Breitner. You've pulled that from the deck. So I was going to save this for extra time, but we'll get into it now. What World Cup fact is interesting about Paul Breitner that we have erroneously not commented on so far in our series?
Paul Breitner is the father of Rory McGrath.
That's such a niche joke, but I really want people to go and Google it because that's a really good shout. It's a really good shout.
I don't know, actually, no.
So, Vava, Pele, Zinedine Zidane, what have they all got in common that we've spoken about?
Scored in two World Cup finals?
Along with Paul Breitner.
What other one did he score?
He has scored in two World Cup finals.
No, he didn't.
Mate, I'm telling you, it was the 82 final that Paul Breitner scored in. So
I've had a blank about the 82. When we get there, you're going to have to fully educate me.
I'm going to have to educate myself as well. But nevertheless, Paul Breitner is up there with the likes of Vava, Pele and Zinedine Zidane.
There we go.
So that's a good pub quiz one. If you had to name all four people that have scored in two World Cup finals.
Yeah,
that's
I would never have guessed that.
Let me give you a bit of context about the 74 final. So, as you said, it's hosted in West Germany. West Germany and East Germany were still split at this point, and it's the only World Cup where both of them would be present.
Right.
So,
they weren't landing 50, were they? Remember covering that?
Yeah, so there were some huge and historic teams that failed to qualify as well for this tournament. So, obviously, the 1966 champions, England, did not come to this tournament. France, Mexico, Spain, Portugal, Belgium, Czechoslovakia, Hungary and Romania and the USSR.
Wow.
Did not feature in this World Cup, which maybe it's easy to look back with hindsight, isn't it? But I wonder if that adds to the dourness feeling of it. A lot of big names there, a lot of countries that would light up the tournament, especially considering like Portugal and Czechoslovakia, Hungary, England, France. Like these are teams that had got to quarterfinals and semifinals and winners.
They became European champions 2 years later.
Yeah. So it's very, very bizarre.
Wow.
I'm sure there's another podcast out there that might break down the qualifying runs of these World Cups, but we don't have the time for that. So as you mentioned at the start, Brazil kept the original Jules Rimet trophy, which saw the new... And the Jules Rimet, I know it's just named after a bloke, but there's something nostalgic and romantic. I thought, oh, I wonder what this trophy is called. It's the FIFA World Cup trophy. Yeah. There's no name for it. It's not
of course
like,
their name's going to be on it.
It's very, very upsetting. But it was created by the Italian sculptor Silvio Gazzaniga. A small bit on him at the end of this report. So this was the first time the Netherlands had qualified, though, since 1938, which, considering they obviously make it to the final, light up this World Cup. It was their first one in recent memory. So, yeah, like, Rinus Michels is managing them, one of the world's best ever managers. Like, it's they were a force. So it is interesting.
It is random, isn't it? Where were they in 1970? That's something I would like to look into.
With that, the tournament this year featured a new format. So I think you mentioned this when we had previously spoken about the World Cup that didn't have a final. This was the competition began with 16 teams divided into four groups. And then the eight teams which advanced did not enter a knockout stage, as in previous World Cups. They just went into another group stage.
Yeah, they did that in 78 as well.
Yeah, that's right. So just two group stages, one after another. It was also the first World Cup tournament that introduced a penalty shootout after extra time.
Oh, really?
It didn't feature in this World Cup. And I don't think it features in the next one either.
So 82,
Yeah, so that's the first time it actually comes into effect. But interestingly enough, the rules there from 1974.
Right.
But to talk about the two teams that make it to the final. So the Dutch were managed by legendary manager Rinus Michels, the man who pretty much fathered total football.
Total football,
For anyone that doesn't know what total football is, it's essentially everyone in the team being technically skilled enough to play every position to a high level. So it doesn't matter if your striker ends up at centre-back. It doesn't matter if your right-back is... on left midfield, they know their role, they know their
in
positions.
Some ways, I feel like you were born to play in a total football team. Because like, put you in centre-back, and I find you up front.
Oh okay. That's not quite the compliment. I was literally about to go, that might be the greatest compliment you've ever given me. That is cruel.
You've played in multiple positions.
That's true. Mainly when I was supposed to be in one. Lou, you're playing right-back. I hear what you're saying. Right-back behind their striker. Right-back up in their face. So, getting back to the report, this man, Rinus Michels, for those that don't know, just come along with me on a history lesson. So he was named Coach of the Century by FIFA in 1999. In 2007,
really?
He was voted the greatest post-war football coach by the Times. And in 2019, the greatest coach in the history of football by France Football. So he is a guy that I think the reason he did win
it's
things...
It's incredible being that he didn't win the World Cup.
No, he didn't. But he would obviously win a Euro. He managed the Dutch team, I think, four times, four separate stints.
Oh, okay. So he was manager in 88, was he?
Yeah, he was manager in 88. But I think the reason that he has such high esteem isn't just his achievements, because there are obviously managers that have achieved more, but it's the fact that modern football is basically birthed from this kind of style. Obviously, we had that kind of Jogo Bonito of Brazil where there was quite free-flowing, but that was a lot on individuals within the team just being allowed to express themselves. This was the first tactical modern system that everything kind of comes off of. This and Catenaccio, which we've spoken about before, are really the two opposite sides of the spectrum, and everything is just a take of those two styles. So, interestingly enough, just to give a bit of context to why Holland, despite the fact this was their first World Cup in a long time, were heavy favourites coming in. Johan Cruyff was obviously the Dutch player. And I've decided, Adam, you'll be pleased to know, to not get excited.
Aroused,
whichever word you want to use for it, talking about Johan Cruyff today, because what else can you say about Johan Cruyff? Like, if you want to learn about him, you can, but he just epitomises everything that I love about football.
We're actually going to release a separate podcast, which is just you on your own talking about Johan Cruyff. I'm not going to be
Don't give me hope. Don't tease me.
You can do it.
If you know it's the final episode of the final countdown.
Unfortunately, listeners, it's 19 hours long.
And you know that that's going to be our way of announcing the final countdown is finished, when I'm allowed to do a 17 and a half hour pod on Johan Cruyff. Safe to say that he'd moved, I think, for £1 million. He'd moved to Barcelona the year before this World Cup.
Can't be £1 million, mate.
Trevor Brooken, first ever.
Trevor Francis.
Trevor Brooken.
First £1 million transfer. Well, that could have been British.
I think that's British. Yeah, I'm certain he went for about £1 million.
I mean, if you had £1 million in your pocket,
you'd go
buy
with
Cruyff or Francis.
I mean, even Cruyff's got the better hair as well, and that takes some saying. But West Germany were managed by Helmut Schön, who was manager both in 66 and in 70.
Oh, really?
So,
wow.
Bearing in mind that obviously Holland, especially through the tournament, blitz everybody. Mm. Germany don't have a stellar tournament. They get the results when needed, but they're not blowing teams away. But Helmut Schön, the manager, had obviously had pedigree. They finished second in 66. They finished third in 70.
Yeah.
And spoiler alert, they go on to get gold and win this tournament. So he clearly had managerial chops as well, but didn't have the, I guess, the branding, the
or didn't have the
tactic.
Players.
Well, that's what's interesting is the German team, I think this one is the one, which obviously isn't a surprise because they go on to win it. But when you look at the team sheet, this is the first one, having looked through 66 and 70, where you kind of recognise a couple of players. Mm. This one is a strong team. So they have Settmeier in goal, Bertie Vogts, Paul Breitner, Franz Beckenbauer, Uli Hoeneß, Jupp Heynckes, and Gerd Müller, der Bomber.
So, Gerd Müller.
Gerd Müller, a man who knew where the goal was.
Yeah.
Dare I say it, he's a slightly better Lineker. That's that's the easiest way to describe him to an English audience.
No.
By what measure are you saying that Lineker is better than Gerd Müller?
Have you ever seen Gerd Müller's bronze thighs?
That's a very personal question. I appreciate you asking me that on the pod, Anne.
No.
For those that don't know, Gerd Müller, nicknamed Der Bomber, simply The Bomber. Not very imaginative there, or difficult to translate from German to English. But Gerd Müller was quite frankly, a goal machine.
Yeah.
He was one of the first out-and-out, I think, poachers. Where
That's a great way to describe
his build-up play wasn't...
None of them are special. None of the goals he scores are special.
No, and that's where the Gary Lineker, for those that are perhaps more used to kind of British... touchstones comes in the comparison, because he just knew where the goal was all the time. And like you say, if you look up Gerd Müller's goals, it's impressive the amount he scores and the rate he scores them at, and in big games, but they are almost always from within 12 yards.
Yeah.
Like, there are very few which he's hit outside the box. And a lot of them, he doesn't score with his head. It's all just toe pokes, tap-ins, scrambles with the goalkeeper, just getting a toe in. He's just knows where the goal is. His instinct is incredible, and that plays a big part in this final. So Germany, it's worth saying, were reigning European Championship holders coming into the tournament.
Were they?
So that was their first success. It wasn't a shock by any means, but they weren't favourites for the 72 Euros.
That's probably why the manager retained for the third World Cup.
Yeah.
The fact they'd had some
success. Yeah. And to be fair, I guess you look at, again, comparing everything to Britain, but you look at Southgate or England and you think, well, the reason Southgate has probably had longer in the job than anyone else is the fact that we've had a second place finish and fourth place finish.
It's results, isn't it? I think people are weird with the whole Southgate out thing. Like, I'm not his biggest fan in the world, but results is the name of the game. And if you look purely on that...
He's our most successful manager since Alf Ramsey.
Yeah, so it's a no-brainer.
So I guess similar. What we're saying really is Helmut Schön and Gareth Southgate, have you ever seen them in the same room
exactly,
at the same time?
Yeah. I mean, if you get rid of Southgate, Pardew's next.
Oh,
so.
My God, don't. Because there is a world in which that actually happens somehow.
He's not even mad.
Graham
then,
Potter.
Is he?
Yeah, exactly. He's free for the job. It'll be like Graham Potter.
It'll be Graham Potter. You're
will
right,
still
yeah,
will
yeah.
be the bookie's favourites because Chelsea will bin him off within a year.
Yeah.
Anyway, let's not make that a separate podcast. But it's worth saying that Holland were in a group with Uruguay, Sweden, and Bulgaria. Beat Uruguay and Bulgaria. Drew with Sweden. West Germany topped their group as well, but they did suffer a shock defeat to rivals East Germany along the way.
Yeah.
So it was the one and only time that they had met in a competitive tournament. West Germany were strongly favoured. East Germany weren't pushovers by any means. I thought, I did a little bit of research in this, but don't have a huge amount of time to go fully into it. Mm. But I thought, I bet it was a really fiery derby and the little minnows of East Germany. But actually, East Germany did have a lot of good players. They would win the Olympics around this time as well. So it wasn't the giant killing that I thought, but nevertheless, they were the underdogs. They won 1-0, and what I expected to be a really fiery game was actually more of a symbol of the fact that Germany wanted to be reunited. So you had the East German team that were representing the communist side of occupied Germany, and then obviously the kind of capitalist westernised West Germany.
Yeah.
That was the shock defeat for West Germany. So
that was in the second group stage?
That was in the first group stage. So Holland, this is where they really pick up speed. So after qualifying from the first group stage, so Holland were emphatic in their second group stage. They beat all three of their opponents. Their opponents being Argentina, East Germany, and Brazil. So that is a tough second group.
Yeah.
The fact that they had Argentina, Brazil, and as we've just spoken about, East Germany that weren't quite pushovers.
So I need to publicly apologise to the nation of Brazil. I said that they were an embarrassment, and they actually finished third.
They did.
But they were just a very different team.
Exactly. Yeah. So I don't... you know, the listeners appreciate the apology that I had, but I don't feel it's needed, because Brazil, again, it's a World Cup without a lot of the big teams. And you think if they had been in it, Brazil, like you said, I think you said in the previous podcast, they were a shadow of their former selves. Yeah. Really, Jairzinho and Rivelino are pretty much the only players.
I was going to say, that's still amazing that they still had those World Cup winners.
Yeah.
And not that guarantees success, but...
No, but the impressive thing about Holland during all of that,
digressing you.
That's quite right. So not only did they beat Argentina, East Germany and Brazil, they did it without conceding a single goal.
Wow.
So Holland's total football, whilst being... It is an attacking tactic, but essentially it's what we now understand as tiki-taka or like Barcelona-style football, where it's about keeping possession of the ball as long as possible, because the longer you have the ball, the less opportunities people have to score, which sounds so simple.
Yeah.
But until this point, and as we've seen in pretty much every World Cup, it's about end-to-end football. You attack, the other team gets to attack, then you attack, and this changes it all, where actually we will just suffocate a team by passing around them and moving from position to position.
Can I ask a question about the Dutch goalkeeper? You might not know the
Youngblood.
Youngblood. Why did he wear the number 8 shirt? Was it because of a total football thing?
I have never noticed that.
Yeah.
That is groundbreaking.
I bet that's a total football thing, as in you can play anywhere. So
I want that to be true.
Random.
And without checking it, we're going to say 100% that is fact.
Yeah.
That Youngblood was actually a converted striker.
Yeah.
And before the tournament, they just rolled dice to see who would go and goal.
Who put that shirt on?
Well, he has an absolute blinder as well in this game. So
Youngblood.
Youngblood. going back to Germany, though, so West Germany did win all of their three games as well, but they were less convincing. They conceded a couple of goals, and they were against weaker opposition. So West Germany had to beat Sweden, Yugoslavia, and Poland in the second group stage.
Poland knocked out England in qualifying.
They did.
Yeah.
Very good. So, as you mentioned, Brazil would lose somewhat shockingly to Poland and finish fourth overall.
Mm.
So Poland had a great tournament. But
yeah, they were a good team, Poland. Yeah.
They were. This is what they refer to as their golden generation, which, you know, for a nation like Poland to get third in a World Cup is pretty impressive.
Yeah.
But again, Brazil lost to Poland. They were a shadow of them for themselves, really. But enough about Brazil. Let's get into what actually happened in the final. Quite simply, Adam, what a start. This is pure footballing beauty and brilliance. Holland kick off and proceed to dance around Germany and have them chasing shadows as a prolonged spell of possession leads to Johan Cruyff being brought down in the German penalty box by Uli Hoeneß. As you mentioned earlier, I was going to quiz you on what was special about this penalty, and it is the fact that within 55 seconds, Germany don't touch the ball. They don't get a toe on it.
Like Maguire and Stones knocking it to each other. It's all over the pitch.
It is unbelievable. And honestly, I say this a lot, but please go on YouTube and just watch.
It's brilliant.
It is. Yeah it's amazing. And what I love, and obviously I love it because I'm constantly sat with a semi when we talk about Johan Cruyff.
Is that why you got that cushion?
That's why I record in the dark room. But Johan Cruyff.
I'm not even with you. We're in different houses.
I'm just staring at a poster of Johan 14. So what is incredible about this penalty is not only that Johan Cruyff is the one that charges into the penalty box, gets taken out,
and
wins the penalty. He starts the move by dropping back to centre-back, and when the move after kickoff, so he takes kickoff, he drops back to centre-back after three or four passes, collects the ball. He is the deepest player for Holland on the halfway, just inside his own half.
And he played just behind the front man?
Exactly, yeah. Absolutely incredible that he plays centre-back and then he disappears out of the screen for 10 seconds. And the next thing you know, he's receiving the ball then in the middle of the pitch and he charges a whole length of the football pitch. You don't realise, or I haven't remembered because it's total football, that he picks the ball up from just inside the Germany half and he runs into the Germany box without anybody stopping him. And the panic it creates is what makes Uli Hoeneß kind of jump in and give away the penalty. So Cruyff takes part in the move at centre-back, receives it. And when the penalty is awarded, do you know the person who scores? Famed for his penalties.
Niskins.
Very good. Johan Niskins.
Yeah, I know Cruyff didn't take it,
No, so Niskins, and then after him, I love that for all the finesse and beauty of total football Netherlands team, that they always seem to have a player who just loves to twat a ball.
Yeah.
Johan Niskins and then Ronald Koeman.
Ari Hahn,
yeah.
From 40 yards.
Exactly, yeah. So... it's almost like, okay, when a lockpick doesn't work, let's use a sledgehammer. And so Johan Niskins, again, if you just watch the penalty after it's been awarded, he absolutely leathers the ball straight down the middle of the goal. Yeah. Keeper dives
No finesse to it.
No, not at all. But you do think, like, unless Sepp Maier, who is the German goalkeeper, unless he had literally planted himself and it was going to hit his body. It's the only way he's keeping it out. A hand wouldn't have kept it out. He hits it so hard. But Johan Neeskens, within 55 seconds of the penalty being awarded, gives Holland the lead.
They must have thought they were going to walk it.
So a quote, I didn't write down who said it, a quote by one of the German, I think he was the other centre-back that wasn't Franz Beckenbauer for Germany. He said that when the Dutch turned up, the attitude seemed to be, how many goals are we going to beat you by today? Wow. Is how he felt. And the German team were like, they had such confidence. The Dutch truly didn't seem nervous. Wow. They just thought, well, of course we're going to win this. And a lot of people did. They, like, Germany were the underdogs in this situation. So after Johan Neeskens has made it 1-0, the game begins to level out with neither side having that many clear-cut opportunities. Germany trying their luck from range and Holland keeping possession as expected. But there is a breakthrough that comes in the 25th minute. Again, from the penalty spot, but this time for Germany. So it's Maverick, Paul Breitner.
World Cup final scoring.
Only four men to have achieved it that we can
Zidane.
Confirm. So do you know what's interesting about Paul Breitner being a left back?
He's right-footed.
Yeah, yeah, right-footed. And he is the Johan Neeskens.
Oh, he takes a penalty with his right foot,
doesn't he? Takes a penalty with his right foot. He loves to cut inside and hit a long-range shot with his right foot. But Paul Breitner, he's a genuine maverick. If you look into what he did in his life, he's a crazy, crazy man. But nevertheless, when the pressure was on, he steps up. The scores are levelled. And West Germany start to build with Big Mo. They've invited her back this time to come and live with her.
Lovely girl.
She's a lovely girl. And they're thinking about getting serious with her. And so Big Mo is truly on their side, and Bertie Vokes manages to get one-on-one with Jongblood, only to fire at the Dutch goalkeeper, who's able to palm it wide. So this is where Jongblood starts to put in a number of saves that managed to keep Holland within touching distance. There is a small note, though, nothing to do with the game in terms of influencing the score, but this was played at the Olympiastadion, which is the German national stadium, and there's a running track around the pitch, as you kind of see, especially in older stadiums. When any player has a corner, they are taking their run-up from about 10 metres away. They're, like, starting on the fifth.
Because the space is there.
It's so strange, It's so bizarre to watch. It really jumped out at me, where I was like, this is an interesting quirk, where they're in, like, the fifth lane of a running track, and then they run for about 10 metres before it in the corner. Just very, very...
Whereas now, they get, like, 4 yards.
Yeah, exactly.
If that.
It's very, very strange to see. But 35 minutes in, Germany is starting to pepper the Dutch goal and almost take the lead from a great free kick by Louis Franz Beckenbauer that Jongblood, again, dives and saves to keep out. Holland do launch a counter-attack that Cruyff unselfishly lays off, but the shot is saved excellently by Sepp Maier. Germany would go into the half in the lead, though, as Der Bommer gets his World Cup goal.
So, oh, in the first half?
In the first half.
Oh, I didn't know that.
After good work on the right from Bonhof, the West German midfielder found Müller 6 yards out, but he's still got a lot to do. He's got a defender on his back and the goalkeeper at almost point-blank range, and he does this thing where he takes half a step away from goal and the defender goes with him, which allows him to kind of like spin and just hit a snapshot in
the ball's behind him as well, wasn't
it? Yeah, so he's like 5 yards out. Yeah. But again, it's what we spoke about at the start, that poacher's instinct. Really, really impressive. And Gerd Müller gets the goal that gives West Germany the lead. So it turns out, I found out, to be Müller's last goal for West Germany because he retired from international football after this tournament.
No,
so he went out on a high. Quite a short international career.
Yeah, I was going to say, he played 2 World Cups.
Yeah, for a guy that is arguably one of the best German strikers, if not the best German striker
ever.
Well,
he was the highest, until Ronaldo, he was the highest World Cup scorer, wasn't he?
That's right, yeah.
As in combined World Cups, not that one.
You're quite right. Interestingly enough, as the teams walked off the pitch at halftime, Cruyff was booked for arguing with the referee.
Was he?
Why stop the habit of a lifetime? He loved giving people an authority stick. So the start of the second half was all Germany, and Bonhof, who assisted Müller, had a completely free header to increase the lead, but only managed to power it wide. It's very strange. Again, you watch it, there's not a single Dutch defender within 3 yards of him, and he just powers a header, but it goes far too wide. Sepp Maier makes a mess as he tries to punch a corner clear, and it has it spin towards the German goal before being headed off the line, which really is the last time the Dutch kind of threatened the German goal. So they were determined to get back in the game, and Neeskens hits a really, really strong volley, but it's straight into Maier's stomach. And that's kind of it. Around the 75th minute, Cruyff has a Gazza moment where he can't connect to a fizzing cross that would have definitely equalised for Netherlands. Then you have Rep, who drives wide after a really good run into
Johnny
the
Rep.
Box. Johnny Rep. But he can't find the breakthrough. And so the game comes to an end with Germany being crowned world champions, quite rightly as well. I think my memory was that this is the best team to have never won the World Cup, and Holland were robbed. But actually,
Holland get the headlines, but actually Germany did the job, didn't they?
They were deserved winners. Yeah. You look at the extended highlights. I didn't watch the whole game. I watched kind of 15-20 minutes highlights, and Germany are the better team, quite frankly, and as much as that pains me to say, they were deserved winners of the World Cup final. So join us as we go into extra time.
Well, you have just witnessed 90 of the most gripping minutes of European football you will ever, ever see. But the good news is there's more to come.
Okay, so I'm going to rifle through extra time because this episode's running a bit long. So, interestingly enough, the start of the match was delayed because the ground staff at the stadium had removed the corner flags for the opening ceremony and forgot to put them back.
Brilliant.
So they had to delay kickoff by 4 minutes while somebody literally runs around putting the flags back
Fantastic.
In.
Fantastic.
We touched on Paul Breitner, so I won't go over that. The World Cup trophy sculptor, Gazzaniga, also created the UEFA Super Cup and the UEFA Cup trophies due to his new fame.
Oh, really?
So he just entered a competition. I didn't say that. He entered a competition for the World Cup trophy.
Yeah.
They picked his design, and because of that, he got to design two more. So that was interesting
no
enough.
Way.
The World Cup trophy, contrary to the Rimei Cup, will never be presented to the team that wins the World Cup three times.
I was going
to
ask that. Yeah. Right, okay.
It will continue to be awarded as a prize until 2038, when all the available inscription spaces have been filled, which I thought was quite interesting. The fact that...
And then what?
And then they will have to create a new trophy, so they'll once again have a new design. So not
in our lifetime, mate.
Yeah, I was like, oh, that's ages away. And then I thought, oh no, it's really not that far away.
10, things considered. 15 years, yeah.
So João Havelange, who is a former FIFA president, Brazilian.
Yeah, I remember him.
Interestingly said in 2008 that the 74 and 66 World Cups were fixed so that the host country would win. This was his exact quotes. And we can discuss whether this has any merit or not afterwards. Yeah. But his quote is... In the three matches that the Brazil team played in 66, of the three referees and six linesmen, seven of them were British and two were Germans. Brazil went out, Pelé exited through injury, and England and Germany entered into the final, just as the Englishman, Sir Stanley Rouse, who was president of FIFA at the time, wanted. In Germany in 74, the same thing happened. During the Brazil-Holland match, the referee was German. We lost 2-0 and Germany won the title. We were the best in the world and had the same team that had won the World Cup in 1962. In Chile and 1970 in Mexico, but it was planned for the host countries to win.
Wow.
So that's what João Havelange, who, it's worth saying, like every FIFA president, is a very shady man anyway. Initially, I was like, oh, that makes a lot of sense. That sounds like it's got something to it. But actually, there are no contentious decisions in the finals.
This is my thing about the ref being the point of contention.
Exactly.
The ref isn't that, unless it sticks out like a sore thumb... The ref can't influence a game that easily.
No, he has to give the penalty. He has to give the penalty to Holland straight away in the final because Jan Cruyff is taken out and he gives it. There's a penalty shout for Germany I didn't cover late in the game. It's a bit of an obvious dive, but enough there that it wouldn't have been the worst decision in the world if he had been fooled and he doesn't give it. So I'm kind of like, you're just a Brazilian who can't take the fact that your team...
It doesn't add up.
No. And also when he said, you know, it's the same team that were in 1962 in Chile and 1970 in Mexico, that literally isn't true.
No.
It's very strange. So I just want to throw it out there because there is a very, very small contingent on the internet.
I think all that's confirmed is that people who run FIFA are crazy.
Agreed. I have nothing to add to that, but that is the endorsed message of the final countdown. So there is one... there's one more fact, and then unfortunately it's a little bit of a sad end because of this really interesting story that I really wanted to get into today's report, even if it's slightly longer. But the final fact, Ad, can you tell me who scored or who got the golden boot in the 74 World Cup?
Well, it wasn't Müller.
It was not.
Was it the Polish guy?
Very good. I will be amazed if you know his name.
I only know one Polish is the goalkeeper, and then a guy who played in the 80s called Boniek.
No. Oh, Boniek, now we're talking. What a player. There we go. That's going to be part two of my solo pod. So the golden boot went to Gregorz Lato of Poland, scoring 7 goals in the tournament. So this truly kind of golden generation, he managed to get the golden boot. So well done, Gregorz Lato. You can go up there with somebody like Just Fontaine.
Yeah, the same.
Yeah.
I'm bracing myself for the bad story here.
So one of the most famous footballing videos from the 74 World Cup is Zaire taking on Brazil. So Zaire had qualified for their first and only World Cup, and everyone knows the story of the Zaire player running forward, booting the ball from the Brazilian team.
That's 74, I thought it was 78, right?
So that was 74, and what was initially laughed at and ridiculed was part of a much larger story, not really promoted until or kind of made public until the last decade or so. It's quite sad, really, but I thought it was interesting because of this narrative, to kind of reframe it. So, labelled as, and this is a quote, "a bizarre moment of African ignorance" by commentator John Motson, Zaire's Mwepo Ilunga charged the stationary ball down from the position of the wall and booted it downfield, which is very funny out of context.
It was,
to see
yeah,
it.
Yeah.
Really, really funny. And you're kind of like, what is going on? Yeah. How is it? How have they got to this level of a World Cup?
And it's the pleading of innocence after is exactly. very funny. Yeah.
So Zaire, at the time, which would later be renamed the Democratic Republic of Congo, so Zaire were under the rule of dictator Mobutu Sese Seko, who was fixated on using football as a show of his dominance over the rest of Africa, and to show Africa as a strong presence in the world. So Mobutu did not travel to the World Cup, but he made sure that there was a strong Zairean presence in West Germany at the time. High-ranking government officials and members of the military travelled with the Zaire team. Wow. They were sent over to give the team the best chance of success, but things did not go to plan. So after an admirable 2-0 defeat to a strong Scottish team, a dispute about match payments broke out, with many players believing that the officials from their country had already taken their fees for playing the games.
Right.
Chaos broke out amongst the squad, and eventually the only way around was for FIFA themselves to pay 3,000 Deutschmarks to the team to convince them to play.
Wow.
So they would go on to lose 9-0 to Yugoslavia in the next game, a record World Cup loss. But that was in part due to the fact that 5'4" Tabalando Nadimi was subbed in as goalkeeper because he was friends with one of the Zairean government's officials.
No way.
So, they, to be fair, they were 3-0 down after 20-odd minutes, obviously not wanting to play,
yeah.
Being forced in a way to play, considering that they were being robbed by the people that were
yeah.
kind of chaperoning them. And, yeah, so Tabalando and DB, 5'4", brought in as goalkeeper because he was friends with the government official. Wow. He would obviously let in another 6 goals and humiliation would kind of be served. So after that, on a world stage, dictator Mobutu was furious. He ordered several of his personal bodyguards to fly over to Germany to threaten the national team. They did exactly that, telling the squad that if they lost by more than 3 goals to reigning world champions Brazil, they would and this is a quote, they would not be allowed back in the country. So seeing all the threatening undertones of a statement like that and what that could possibly be interpreted as, yeah. that's where we come to the second half of the final group game, where Zaire are currently 2-0 down and the players are starting to panic and fearing for the worst, for their lives, which is why the Zaire player runs forward, boots the ball away to try and time waste, to try and delay the game as much as possible, make it a farce. Zaire do concede another goal, so it's 3, but because they didn't lose by more than 3, they were allowed back in the country.
Wow.
But it obviously ruined the lives of a number of that.
That is absolutely players. Nuts.
Absolutely crazy, the fact that for years and years and years, it hasn't really been made public, everything that was going on. And there was a lot of kind of looking down the noses, as we've seen from FIFA in this tournament, and the way they've treated African continents, African nations this whole time. But I thought it was also really fascinating, as sad as it is, really interesting that when you see that clip, everything that's going on behind
the context of that is incredible, isn't it?
Amazing. Yeah. So, sorry, it's a little bit sad to end on, but it is interesting, and it's all part of the World Cup tapestry.
Well, it sets us up beautifully for next week, mate.
Oh, good, yeah. So with that wonderful cliffhanger, do you want to give us a little tease about what we can expect next week?
Well, next week it's incredibly interesting, but it is intense. Argentina take on the world, not really at football, just everything else.